Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Never mind that, Jim. Noah Crane just sent us a huge box of hats. There's like 20 hats in here, Jim. Jim, there's like 20 hats in here. I can't believe Noah Crane.
Okay, Patrick, it is time to check in with one of our patrons and one of our favorite people, I would
Absolutely.
Say, right?
Yeah. It's always super refreshing to talk to our guest today and really co-host, right? Because yeah. When patrons come on, we're kind of following where they want to go. Mm-hmm. And every topic has been really interesting. And also, I think this guy works in one of the coolest possible careers you could have.
I know. So I want to get into that in a second here. So yeah. It's a patron episode on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I am Patrick Foster.
And the way this works is people who are patrons of the show, they help us out. They go to patreon.com/suburbspod and they help us out with the show. And they get to come on every so often and they get to pick the topic. We'll talk about pretty much whatever they want. I don't think we've rejected a topic yet. So it's out there. As long as it's about music, we're good with it.
Right.
And this particular patron, his name is Noah Crane. He's up there in New Hampshire. Hello.
I am. Great to be here with you guys.
Great to have you as always. He's been on a few times before. We've always had lively conversations. And you mentioned that he has a cool job. So tell people, Noah, again, like what it is that you do.
I am the founder and president of the Upper Valley Nighthawks. And the Upper Valley Nighthawks are a summer collegiate baseball team that plays in the New England Collegiate Baseball League. So we take college baseball players from all over the country, bring them up here to, actually we play in Vermont, I live in New Hampshire, play in Vermont and travel around New England for the summer. It's an opportunity for these guys to showcase their skills for the major league scouts in hopes of going on to play professional baseball when their college career is done. So we focus a lot on entertainment and use baseball as the vehicle to do that, to build community, to entertain our fans and provide an affordable night out.
That's wonderful. And unfortunately, you know, things got disrupted this year because of the crisis in America. But hopefully by next year, things will be in a better spot for you all.
I hope so.
Yeah. And it is so cool. Noah, I just want to ask you too, before we dive into today's topic, give us your take on, you know, the 2020 baseball season and especially the World Series, which, was kind of crazy. It was a weird, crazy sports year, yet the teams with the two best records ended up in the World Series.
Yeah, it's funny how that happened, that in that shortened season, the teams that had the best record in the National League and the American League wound up in the playoffs. It shows that they were the best team. So we got what kind of we deserve. I think baseball deserves a lot of kudos for pulling off a season. Mm-hmm. They could have very easily pulled the plug, and they knew that, one, the players wanted to play, fans wanted to watch the game, and it would have been very difficult to just have no baseball. It would have been strange.
I know.
Baseball's already suffering to some degree in popularity, and for it to go dark for a year, I think really would have adversely affected the game. So I think they deserve some credit for pushing forward. It wasn't perfect. It was a little strange. And certainly not having fans at stadiums and hearing the ambient noise was a little odd. But the fact that there were games on and people could follow their players and the playoffs were really compelling. There was a lot of great baseball being played, games that were interesting, extra inning games. So I think they did a good job.
Very well said.
I totally agree. And I got to say that to me, just having baseball being played, like I said, even under these, less than optimal conditions, it felt like hope in some way in America,
Amen.
It felt like some bit of normalcy, like baseball is American summer, mm-hmm. and just to not have it for half the summer or however long it was just felt really weird. So I was happy to have it back. And I also want to say that I'm the only person in my household who watches baseball at all. And so even the World Series, I was trying to rally people like, come on, watch this World Series. It's the American thing to do, and they need us and in a neutral site and it's all different. And I was trying to pump people up and everybody was just like, I'm going upstairs, whatever. So
I'm sorry, were you talking? Dad.
So I watched the World Series, and it was great. And I want to say one thing, when you mentioned collegiate baseball, is that one of the Dodgers, the catcher, Will Smith, he went to the University of Louisville.
Oh, great.
Where I have a connection there. My wife graduated from the University of Louisville, and we lived there for 10 years. So we had a nice rooting interest there, too, in the Dodgers, and they ended up winning.
Will Smith actually played in our league.
No way. Did he
I knew
really?
As soon as I bring that up, he'd say we played there, because everybody has, I think, right?
We've had a lot of top flight talent come through us. Sadly, my one miss was Walker Buehler, who's pitcher for the Dodgers. Yeah. I had him under contract, and Vanderbilt decided to keep him home because he had thrown too much in the spring, so they didn't send him up to play for us. But I've got a signed contract with Walker Buehler's name on it.
Wow, that's pretty good, man. That's very good.
All right, so what is the music topic that we want to discuss today?
I've been listening to a ton of the band lately, primarily the Brown album, and it's got me thinking about sophomore releases, so bands' second albums, and just how interesting it is where sometimes you have a band that has an amazing first album and they have all this pressure to come out with a follow-up that's just as good or maybe even better. And then you have other bands whose first album is a little bit unknown or kind of clunky and not well put together, and their second album is a triumph. And sometimes it's something in between. So I just think it's a fascinating concept about what does a band do to follow up their first album. And listening to the band as much as I had and listening to the Brown album, it got me thinking about that, and then diving into my catalog to see what are some of the other sophomore releases that I really love and enjoy. And there are obviously a bunch. And I thought along with that, it would be a topic that a lot of the podcast listeners would dig in and come back with phone calls and stuff about what their favorites are.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well chosen. It is a fascinating topic. And right, guys, there's that ancient cliche in the music business. You have your whole life to make your first album and you have 6 months to make your second one, you know? And in many cases, that was true, especially back in the 60s and up until the mid 70s when it was like, wow, we just got a hit. We need more product, right? Like, let's crank it out. So super interesting.
You will record that thing you do in Spanish.
That's right.
You get 2 songs per side. None of this lover's lament crap. Yeah. Or no, 1 song per side. Anyway,
that's right.
No, but you're right. And I think the second album, and no, Noah's got some really good examples here of a really good second albums, but it's sort of the rare second album that improves upon the first, right?
In most cases, right?
Because of, I think, the dynamic you're saying, which is that maybe they put, you know, what they thought were all their best songs on the first album, and then it's right. Like the second one becomes sort of like, what else you got? And they haven't really had time because they've maybe been so busy, if they had a hit first album, touring and promoting that and what have you. And then a lot of times you'll see bands come back around for that third or fourth record and sort of find their footing, right? But it's that second one that can often be sort of the misstep, I think, sometimes. And but occasionally they really, you know, build upon something.
Well, and I think the Brown album's a perfect example of building upon the promise of the first record and taking it to places where you're like, wow, like, I can't even believe that. I mean, I'll tell you, the song Caledonia Station is an amazing, amazing song. I was obsessed with that song for quite a long time. In a station, I should say, not Caledonia Station. What they did, how much deeper they got to the things they did on the first record is amazing. And often it tells the story of a band. I mean, like the band, you know, they were working with Dylan, they were with Ronnie Hawkins for a while, you know, they sort of always knew they had a chemistry and they sort of proved it to the max on the second album. And a lot of times too, let's think about The Knack, for example. They put out a huge selling first album with a single that broke the radio and like, oh, these guys are going to crank out hits for 20 years. No, they never did anything again.
Right.
You know, sometimes the second album is like, I'm going to go all in, and it's, wow, you had nothing. Right? You had like a 4 and a 3. Yeah. So
Noah, what is it that you love about the Brown album?
I've always been attracted to story songs. And I think this album is just filled with characters and stories and interesting narratives and cool names and people and places. And the band does that so very well.
Yeah.
And they do it with such warmth. And I've always, you can't be a child of boomer parents and not know the band.
Right.
And so that's always been in the background. I wouldn't say my parents were huge band fans, but I always heard The Wait. I always heard The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. Mm. And that those two songs in particular captivated me because of just the weird narratives that are going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Last Waltz version of The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down is just amazing. But the studio version is fantastic too. But there are so many incredibly written songs on this album that it's hard to not put down. And as old as it is, like I was negative 10 when this album came out, that you're still listening to it 50 years later because of the power of the songwriting and the harmonies and the stories that these guys tell.
Yeah. There you go.
95. We were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down,
you know, probably the biggest album in their career, right?
Yeah, I think most people would say that this is their pinnacle. I mean, they certainly have other great albums. I love Northern Lights, Southern Cross.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I really like that album a lot, but I think most critics would say that the Brown album is their peak. As good as Songs from the Big Pink is, and This Is It. And I love the cover too. You look at the cover and it looks like it came from some mining town in the 1860s.
Yeah.
So these guys standing out in the rain looking like they're 100 years old. It's just evocative.
Yeah, totally. What was next on your list? Yeah,
gonna shift gears completely and go from the band to New Order. And
what?
Power, Corruption, and Lies from 1983. Couldn't be more different from the band album.
No, that's right.
You know, this is the album that where they are fully formed as New Order. Movement, which comes out in 81, is more like Joy Division, but without Ian Curtis. And it sounds way more like Joy Division, and they're still trying to figure out who's playing what parts. Is Bernie Sumner going to be the lead singer? Is Peter Hook going to be the lead singer? What do we do? And we shift over to Power, Corruption, and Lies, and they feel fully formed. And they've grasped sort of what they are as a band, which is this sort of power pop. And I'm actually surprised that no one has called in to power pop with the lead track on this album, which is Age of Consent.
Yeah.
Which is just perfect. And this album, top to bottom, is pretty flawless. They're known kind of as a singles band. And some of the singles they put out in the 80s were huge monster sellers, like Blue Monday, for example, the biggest 18-inch of all time. And this album, though, it has a cohesion to it and a depth that they don't get to in other albums. Other albums are solid, have a lot of incredible standout songs that people know, but the top-to-bottomness of this album is pretty unparalleled for them.
Man, could not agree more. And I think Noah said it right. It really is the perfect balance between Joy Division and New Order. I mean, it hits that spot between both of those things, the spookiness, the simplicity, and the depth of the guitar playing. It's very simple, but man, Bernard Sumner was really good at putting the right notes in the right places.
Oh, totally. And yeah. I think this is an interesting case because here you have a band that had some history even before their debut album.
That's right.
So that it's almost like that debut album is sort of the transitional one. And the second one is almost kind of like the debut in some ways.
Or
like,
very interesting. Really band, yeah, I mean? Right. Another interesting reason why this is such a cool topic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it falls into, is Movement really a New Order record?
Right.
It's probably more Joy Division, written during Joy Division. It's just without Ian Curtis. So, you could make the case that perhaps that this is their debut. I'm going on a technicality.
Yeah. No, you're right. This is
that this is their sophomore release.
Well, I Yeah, I do think Movement is a New Order record. I mean, it warrants a whole episode probably, but the decision to continue right away, right, after Ian Curtis, you know, had passed away and not ever look back is to be commended, I think. In music history, it all depends, you know, what the linchpin is. But like you said, Noah, this was like a really, really strong band too. And you could make the probably bad, you know, analogy of the Doors and Joy Division, right? Like the Doors continued to play after Jim Morrison died, you know, at one point. And it was like, oh my God, Jim Morrison was everything about the Doors and more.
Yeah.
Am I still talking?
No.
I've never heard anyone compare the Doors and New Order before.
I just thought about it, and they kind of lost their lead singer. And wow,
yeah. All right. Know? That's a really good one. That's going to be hard to top that one.
Oh, my God. That is going to be hard to top.
I'm really curious what's coming up next.
I hope he's going to pick what I hope he picks.
I'm staying in the 80s, and I think that I'm contractually obligated to talk about REM when I come on the pod. And so REM's 84 album, Reckoning, the follow-up to their brilliant release, Murmur, which came out in 83. And similar to what Patrick was talking about before, is there was a rush and a push to get this out.
Yep.
They had a minor hit, certainly a hit on college radio with Murmur. They had a great deal of critical acclaim for Murmur. And so they were swiftly pushed back into the recording studio to get Reckoning done. And I think the guys were a little tired from it. There's a lot of stories about how Michael struggled to get the lyrics down, the vocal tracks down, because he was so wiped out from touring and from the album. But they still came out with a gem. And I don't know if it's better than Murmur. It's different, but it's still amazing.
Okay, I'm really happy you picked this.
Me too.
Because when you suggested the topic, before you told me what albums you wanted to talk about, this actually was the first one that came to my mind. And it's
really
such a weird... And the reason why I kind of wanted to talk about this one is because it's not any kind of diss at all on Murmur. Murmur is a fantastic album, and I've listened to it, I can't tell you how many times, right? But I've always had a preference for Reckoning for some reason. I've always thought it was just a little bit better, despite what armies of other people would probably fight me on that topic, right? But I always liked it a little bit more. I don't know. To me, it felt like, kind of when we started this, that they built on something, that like they took everything they did really well the first time out and just came back with songs that were just, in my mind, just maybe a little bit sharper, just a little bit more interesting in some ways. I don't know. It just felt like a little more REM. Like, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but this is probably my favorite REM album to this day. And I just, like, there's nothing wrong with it, man. Everything on this album is so good. It's hard for me to describe exactly, but I always thought this is a great example of just like a super strong second album.
Well said, Jim. And I'll add to that just by saying it always sounded to me like the moment when REM knew they were going to be artists and, you know, a band for their whole life, and they were like accepting it and didn't have quite the trying to impress you mysterious quality of Murmur, but it was them kind of relaxing and saying, yeah, we're going to do this. We're really good at it. And, you know, they had gotten some shows around at that time, and I'd love it too. It's probably my favorite REM. It's just so good.
I think you said something that I was trying to say, which is it does. There's a certain effortless quality to this album that I think really makes it work really well.
Yeah.
Like you said, like they just like with any band that you really like, the first album, you're always like, was it a fluke? You know, just happen to capture, you know, the lightning in a bottle or whatever. But here you just like, you got the sense from the second album that like this band could go on forever. You know, like they're just that good, you know,
and I hope they do.
That's right.
Yeah. Generally speaking, that somebody does catch lightning in a bottle, that first album's great, and then you never hear from them again.
Right.
With REM, yes, they had a great first release, but they're improving upon it. And I think, you know, three of us would say they keep doing this. And that's the genius of REM, is that They retain something where you know this is REM, but they're tweaking their sound a little bit. They're getting better each time, and they continue to put out a string of records that are just fantastic. And with Reckoning, they did that so well, and in a time crunch and with the pressures of we've got to follow up Murmur, and they did it. And you don't look at the album and go, this feels rushed. It doesn't feel like they threw in filler.
No.
They have so many strong tracks. There's
totally
so much cohesion. And what it does that I like about it is it really captures kind of their energy and their live sound more than Murmur does. It sounds a little bit more like if you went to an early, not that I did, but if you went to an early REM concert, it would sound a little bit more like Reckoning sounds, whereas Murmur is a little more just murky and produced, whereas Reckoning has more of a live feel to it.
And that's such a great point, Noah, because obviously they played a ton of shows, right? Between those times, and when you play every night, or even if you play three times a week in front of people, you're going to get a lot better and you're going to get much more control over your instrument. And I think especially the harmony between Mike Mills and Peter Buck on bass and guitar really improved during that period. And I think that's, like you said, a product of that live work and sounding live, right? They wanted to capture more of that spirit.
I think that is a really good point. And maybe, you know, it's the same producers as Murmur.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Dixon and Mitch Easter, but maybe even they were
they
sort
just
of
got
like,
better. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they also, as producers, built off of that first record and was like, you know, how can we make this, you know, just a little bit more of an REM record, you know?
Totally.
What have we learned about the band in that time, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, and one other thing I'll just say real quick, if you know much about the band's history and their early history, and like you said, how much they played, but also like how many songs they wrote too. So they were very prolific. And so what made them a step above, I think, a lot of other bands too, is that they were always like working on songs and and weren't really ready necessarily to record them until they felt the song was ready. So you'll find, especially in that early, you know, that first five albums on IRS, that sometimes songs that are just now getting on a record are songs they've been working on a couple of records ago, right?
Yeah.
But they just weren't quite ready to put it out there yet.
Right,
too. So,
right.
So it doesn't necessarily surprise me that they had material for that second album. Like, here you go. This is stuff we've probably been working on for quite a while.
That's a great point.
Yeah, Pretty Persuasion is a example of what you were just talking about, Jim. They had been playing that song for a long time, and they fit it onto that album. Same with Don't Go Back to Rockville. They changed it. They made it a little more country sounding, but those are two that they'd been playing and had been kicking around within the band for years. And so it wasn't as much of that crunch of, oh, shoot, we came out with an album and we have nothing. Let's scramble to put something together. They had a back catalog that they could tweak, and they were always writing.
Yes, and I think the key to it was it wasn't like these were like the backup songs that just like, okay, now, oh crap, we got to record another album. Here's the stuff we didn't use the first time.
Right.
These were songs that maybe were sort of gestating for a while, and now they felt like they were ready.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So it wasn't like B material. To them, I think it was just more A material, just like, now this stuff's ready to be recorded.
Yeah. Completely.
It must be nice to have a song like Pretty Persuasion in your back pocket.
I know, yeah.
Dude, I love that song. That may be my favorite of all their songs.
Yeah. Wow, you're really implicating yourself, Jim.
Yeah, hey, it's on my 500 playlist.
Oh, wow.
Pretty Persuasion is on there.
Okay.
High praise.
Anyway. That is nice.
Okay, and then is there one more you want to talk
about? Yeah, there is.
Okay.
So this is a band called the Gaslight Anthem, kind of a Jersey band.
Yeah.
And I think they're kind of like a Social Distortion / Springsteen, Killers, Tom Petty kind of amalgamation. And this was their second album.
Right.
Came out in 2008. It's called The 59 Sound.
Yeah.
And I heard this album first. So I assumed this was their first album because of how good it is and how tight it sounds.
Yep.
And it took me a couple of years to figure out, oh, wait, this was their second album.
Yeah.
And I followed the rest of their catalog. I really enjoy, again, back to my love of the band, is they're good at story songs as well. And there are a lot of literary and musical references that get peppered into their songs. And just love the energy that these guys have. And I think that this album is incredibly strong. Not that their first one is terrible by any means, but it doesn't have the standout tracks that this album does. And I really enjoy these guys, and sadly they broke up in 2015, but they put together five pretty solid albums.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you brought this one up, because this is one of those bands that back in that era, a little over 10 years ago or so, I really got into them. And then they kind of fell off my radar, and maybe it was because they broke up and didn't really, sustain it, right? So, but now that you mention this, I would like to go listen to this album again. I have this on vinyl. I have the 59 sound.
Oh, do you? Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I went to look for my CD because I know I went out of my way to legally download this record and make a handmade cover and everything and write the songs down because I listened to it somewhere. I think it's really good. And I also think it's a very interesting kind of amalgam of some sounds that were happening in a certain part of the country that eventually I think Titus Andronicus benefited from. You know, there were some bands playing in Jersey and kind of around that mixed a lot of interesting styles. You know, we know how Stickles can take punk and anthems and Springsteen and mix it all up in different ways. But I'd love to hear the Gaslight Anthem.
The title track is pretty great, but I think Great Expectations it's the opening track, and it kicks off with some pretty nice energy.
All right, let's start with the opening track.
Mary, I'm worried, it's cold every night of my life. They're sick, they're making the party, and I've never had a good time. I sat by my bedside with papers and poetry about Estella. With Great Expectations, I saw taillights last night in a dream about my first wife. Everybody leaves and I expected as much from you. I saw taillights last night in a dream about my whole life. Woke with my head unreasonably blue, unreasonable to you.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's just explosive. It just comes out right at
really
you.
Really great. Yep. Really, really good band. What is it mainly, Noah, that appeals for you?
I think that certainly the rock style, which you don't get a lot of much these days.
Yep.
I think they get criticized for being a little too Springsteen-esque or maybe Springsteen mimicking. Mm. But at the same time, if you're going to copy someone, he's a pretty darn good one to copy.
Pretty solid.
Particularly if you're from New Jersey.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sure they got sick of those comparisons and didn't want to hear that. And they do differ in a lot of ways. But again, the stories, the literary allusions of you've got a band that's kind of a punky rock band that's writing a song about a Charles Dickens album. Book.
Right.
Like that. And they drop in sort of little Easter eggs and they name check a lot of their references. You get Springsteen lyrics in there. They do it with Petty. They name drop even Counting Crows, which another band that I love. They do a lot of that, but I just like the energy and the vibe, and it's well-written, well-crafted. It's enjoyable stuff.
Man, and this is a band, Jim, I think our audience probably should embrace in a deeper way. Like, this is a band for our people, man. Like, this is right up everyone's alley. It's so good. You know, it's got, as Noah just laid out, just such great references. And to me, you know, I do hear Titus in this because I think Titus takes it to a different place. They just do it faster and more Stickles, you know, with more marijuana and more Patrick Stickles. And it's got that DNA, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in all these bands, that we're talking about. But yeah, Suburb Spot, folks, if you don't know this one, this is big.
Well, it's funny, too, because I think people know this or understand this kind of like Jersey sound, obviously, from Springsteen. But even at the time Springsteen was coming up, there were a couple other bands that had similar, kind of
totally
sounds, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just interesting that, you know, these other bands carried that on, right? That New Jersey sound.
Absolutely.
But it feels very natural, I think, with the Gaslight Anthem. You mentioned sort of mimicking. I don't get that sense when I hear it. I get the sense that it's just like kind of like what they grew up with. It's what they were influenced by, and they've just kind of run with that, you know?
Well, it's almost like Noah said at the beginning, how Noah heard the band from his parents, too. And, you know, you were kind of hinting about that, too. I think if you live in a certain part of the country, certain bands are popular, and yeah, you're going to learn about them, you know, maybe in ways that most people wouldn't.
That's right. By the way, if you just Google Springsteen Gaslight Anthem, you can find videos of where they've played together. Like,
Springsteen
will like have gone to one of their shows and jumped up on stage and played with them. And I think Brian Fallon, they, you know, vice versa, has played with the Easter Band, you know, it's big shows. So they obviously get along and like each other's music for sure.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I think I read that after Springsteen played with them for a couple of shows in Glastonbury, the sales of this album, 59 Sound, doubled.
Well, there you go. That's the other thing, right? The endorsement. No, it's like Dylan, you know, endorsing the band.
There you go. Exactly. All comes around. So, yeah. So that's another great pick. I need to go listen to that. Yeah. I haven't listened to it in quite a while, but,
fabulous,
but I did buy it. And it came out, what'd you say, 08, 09, something like that?
Yeah, 08.
To me, also, it sort of, I think you hinted at this a little bit about it, that just having that really strong rock sound, it seemed like it also came out at a time when not a lot of other bands were playing kind of straight on rock and roll and this kind of bar band kind of sound. And
that's right.
And so it felt very refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that completely.
Yeah, good point.
All right. Those are four great ones.
Totally. Now I have 73 albums I'd like to list.
Okay.
No, it's good. These are perfect. I mean, I think as Noah said, this is going to open the floodgates for other people because everyone's going to have that great sophomore album example.
There you go. So let's open up those floodgates. If people want to tell us about a second album, an artist's second album that you think is really great, better than the first, or what have you, you can call and leave a message, 612-440-1984. There you go.
Is.
Or send us an email, rock@suburbspod.com, or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. Noah, we appreciate it so much. Thank you for your support and thanks for picking great topics. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And as I mentioned before, hopefully better things lie ahead for us all in the coming year.
I hope you're right. Always great to be with you guys. It's so fun and appreciate the pod. I appreciate the community that you've built and just delighted to be a small part of it.
Man, it means a lot to us, Noah. Thank you so much, man.
And let me ask you this. How many people in your household will watch baseball on television?
All of them.
Oh, you're so lucky.
Yeah. We have to actually send the kids to bed with these later games. They're begging to stay up and watch them.
You're so lucky. I'm just isolated in my own house. Talk about the social
Jim, isolation. You can make a trip to New Hampshire.
I will someday.
There you go.
Things get better. I would love to. Okay, let's get out of here. We'll talk to you again soon, Noah. Again,
yeah, thank you, Noah.
Everybody, you know, send in your calls and letters and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the floodgates are now officially open, folks.
That's about it. So it's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Noah Crane.
All right. We'll talk to you guys later.
We don't like to work too hard and we like to let our listeners do all the work.